Today's Teisho will be on case 27 in the Mumonkan. Nonsense, not mind, not Buddha, not things. A monk asked Nansen, "Is there any Dharma that has not been preached to the people?" Nansen answered, "There is." "What is the truth that has not been taught?" asked the monk. Nansen said, "It is not mind, it is not Buddha, it is not things." Mumon's comment, at this question, Nansen used up all his treasure and was not a little confused. Mumon's verse, "Talking too much spoils your virtue. Silence is truly unequaled. Let the mountains become the sea. I'll give you no comment." Well, I'm happy to observe that everybody's doing an excellent job. People are coming into the Dokusan room, and it's very clear from what they have to say that they're really practicing, and that's just wonderful. It's just a pure pleasure. Last night I was closing up the building here. I was leaving the building, and I noticed that there seemed to be a light on in here, and somebody was sitting late into the night, you know. When I came in this morning, somebody's in the Zendo. I got up around 4, somebody was already in here sitting. And during the day, everybody's practicing very diligently, sitting like rocks. It's just wonderful. It's just a pure pleasure. So thank you for making such a good effort. This koan is really... they're all important. I guess this is another important koan, just like all the other ones. But it's really there's something special about this koan. You might wonder why we eat the way we do. You know, several years ago, Yen and Jaru and Imtiaz and Kriti and Gary and I went up to Bodhi Monastery to investigate using their facilities. And it didn't really, at the time, it didn't really seem to work out, but we went into the dining facility, and basically it was like a combination of a classroom and a cafeteria. So it looked like there was an area where the food would be placed, and people would get up and get some food and put it on, and they had paper plates, as I recall. And then you would put some, or styrofoam plates, and you'd get some food cafeteria style or buffet style. And I think they might have even had trays like a cafeteria. And I thought, ooh, this is not our way, you know, to eat. You know, but it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, we all sit down, we all wait quietly until after everybody's seated for a moment, and then we recite our sutras in unison, and we eat in a highly ritualized way. Now, you know, somebody might say, "Why are you doing this? You know, this doesn't make any sense. Why don't you just eat?" They really don't appreciate the flavor of Zen. You know, there's something about eating together in this way that's very special. You know, really, it does something very powerful, I think. It makes the meal richer experience because we're sharing it together. And it's like we recite these sutras and we say, I take this food solely for the purpose of keeping my body in good health. We all say it at the same time. You know, I'm eating, but you know, even though I love this eggplant, it's just because I need to keep sitting today. And it, you know, it could seem a little corny, but it's actually quite an important part of Zen. It's the same thing as, why don't we all just go off and sit by ourselves, but we all sit together. And there's a kind of collective energy that's very powerful. You know, this aspect of our practice is Confucian. Zen is really a Buddhism. It's Buddhism. But it's Buddhism with a Taoist and Confucian elements. And this is one of the Confucian elements. You know, at one time in China, people were very chaotic. And there was a genius, really, in the West we call him Confucius. And Confucius, you know, everybody's saying, how do we, you know, stop people from being so lawless and selfish, and et cetera, et cetera. And somebody said, why don't we make laws? Well, we'll make some laws. But, you know, Confucius said, you know, laws don't work. And I think he's right. You know, like in the United States, we like to say we're a nation of laws. But, you know, basically, if you want the laws to be changed, you just go and you give some money to your legislator. I mean, let's face it, we live in New Jersey, this is how it's done. And you bribe the legislator and he changes the laws to make it happen what you want to happen. In other words, you know, you can make laws, but it doesn't change people's hearts. And even the president, the last president, broke laws all over the place, and seems to be okay. So the point is that Confucius was a very smart man. He said, laws, you know, you can't. He said, the way to, you have to have people have to have a unified mind. And the way you have to unify hearts. So actually, he said, let's not worry about laws. Let's worry about doing rituals together. And when we do these rituals together, they put us on the same wavelength. See, and then we'll know in our heart. We won't need to have a piece of paper. We'll know in our hearts. You know, his idea was to cultivate the heart, so that you could be ren, humane, you know, humane person. So if we do the rites, like to our ancestors, if we do these rites, we'll harmonize our hearts, and we'll be in sync. See, this is more important than laws. Don't keep us in sync. So this is actually quite a deep insight. Later on the other great school of Chinese thinking was the Taoism, Lao Tzu. And, you know, Confucius said people should be humane. Confucius said, don't worry about the gods. There might be some gods up there and we should do honor them. But really, we just need to take care of humans. And we should promote humane behavior. And Lao Tzu Lao Tzu completely disagreed with Confucius. He said, I totally disagree. He said, people shouldn't try to be more human. They should unify themselves with nature. And in fact, Lao Tzu actually says in the Tao Te Ching, he says, the universe isn't humane. He doesn't say, the universe isn't humane, Confucius. But he really is saying that, you know, Mr. Confucius. He says, the universe isn't humane. Heaven and earth are not humane, is what he says. So he disagrees. He said, don't worry about being human. Harmonize yourself with the way of nature. And then when Buddhism came, I think Buddhism was like a great, played a very important role in Chinese culture, because Buddhism said, you know, you guys are both right. See, I think Buddhism really was good for Chinese culture, because you guys are both right. You know, because humans are part of nature. You know, so I think all of these things fit together in Zen in different ways. You know, but this idea of like collective ritual, even though in our modern Western way of thinking seems superstitious, Confucius didn't believe in magic. You know, he didn't believe in magic. He didn't believe in like petitioning the gods and things like that. He was very dismissive of that. But he knew that ritual ties people's hearts together. And this is very much part of in the spirit of what the Buddha said earlier when we started the session. I read the original teaching of the Buddha where somebody said, I understand, world-honored one, that friendship is half the path. And the Buddha said, no, it's the whole path. You know? So those things really go together. Practicing together is really very important. And as we all see, you know, you couldn't do this probably on your own. You know, something like sesshin, this intense, sustained practice. And just as, you know, you sit better probably on a Wednesday night with other people, you know, even very advanced practitioners would have a hard time having this kind of energy, you know, the collective energy. So this, Americans are probably too individualistic, you know, they're just too much individualistic in a maybe a bad way sometimes. And it's important to value this this collective energy, you know, and the power of this kind of collective action, you know, like when we eat. So this is one element of Zen practice, but there's another element of Zen practice too. You know, Zen is really all about what might be called, well, in, you know, people, even while everything I just said is true, you know, to be a Zen person, you have to have a special kind of personality, or you might not start with that personality. In fact, you probably don't. But if you keep practicing, you begin to have a deeper and deeper kind of, it's like a kind of self-reliance or self-confidence, you know? This is another. These two things don't really contradict, you know, because I think Zen uses the power of our collectivity, of our being together, to create a kind of person who is capable of having great self-confidence, you know, and that. This, you know, Zen people are quite tough. You know, if you practice long enough, you become quite tough. Now, I don't mean hard, like hard-hearted, or you don't go around picking fights with people, you know. That's not what I mean, you know. You know, and it doesn't mean like, you know, contemptuous. Those kinds of behaviors are actually the product of insecurity. You know, actually, insecurity. There's a kind of confidence that doesn't have to prove itself. You know, it doesn't have to be aggressive. It's not aggressive behavior comes out of fear. You know, so like usually the school bully is somebody who has a lot of problems. You know, somebody who's maybe beaten up at home or something like that, you know. You know, generally people who are very aggressive are not really a strong people, not strong, really strong. And I think that Zen creates a kind of imperturbable mind and a kind of very tough personality. And this is, I think, a very good thing. You know, I really do. And it's like, people... people create, I was saying this earlier, but people create an artificial world. It's just a fact, you know, and it seems totally natural to them. You know, someday, it probably won't happen, but it could, you know, someday there will be no wilderness areas left, right? And people won't even know what they are. You know, I don't think this will happen, but it could, you know, if we don't come to our senses, you know. But it could happen, you know. And basically, the whole world could be covered with shopping malls, you know, and suburbs. And if people growing up in such a world would think that was totally natural. Right? They'd say, well, of course, it makes perfect sense, you know. You get in your car. Car is for going. You know? You drive down the road is for cars, you know. You go to the store, that's where you get the things you need, you know. Duh, right? Duh. You know, this is so human, you know. This is really human. It seems totally natural. But of course we know, you know, they might find a book, you know, they might find a book somewhere in like a dusty old library. They might not know what libraries are, you know, at that time. They might, you know, break open a wall, they're putting in a new Walmart or somewhere, and they're tearing down this building and they go, there are these things made of paper inside, you know. And they say, well, nobody reads anymore anyway, you know, so. They open one up and there's pictures in it, you know, but it's not, there's no screen, it's the darndest thing, you know, there's no screen but there's pictures, you know, and they don't move, you know, there's no keys, you know. And there's like a picture of like a forest or a mountain, you know, they say, what the heck is that, you know? And most people would say, oh, who knows, you know, who knows? I think they had stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But somebody, you know, there's a rare person who would say, oh my gosh, you know, maybe our world isn't natural. Now, maybe this isn't natural at all. And then a person might say, I wondered why I felt so unhappy. Yes? You know, I get up every day and... you know, my 14-foot television is on, and you know the Today Show is on, and I took my my food pills or whatever, and I went to work, and I whatever they would do at work, and I took boxes and put them inside of boxes, you know, and just shipped them all across the world. You know, and came home and, watched the tube again, you know. I just felt very empty and unhappy, and I've been taking all these medications, but it hasn't really helped me that much. I've always wondered why, you know, or such a person might actually, like, go to the last forest and say, oh my God, you know, I feel so good here, you know. For many people, it's just a fact that the collective reality is very compelling. And of course, people are not encouraged to have doubts about it, you know. But if you do Zen, you know, you tend to be, I think, the kind of person who at some point said, you know, this doesn't feel right to me, this doesn't feel real. And that's a very difficult decision to make, you know, to cross that line. Because it's scary, because you say, you know, what if I cross this line and I just go stark raving mad, you know? People are afraid to, and you do meet people who have like lost their reason, right? They've lost like all contact with reality. And you say, naturally, I don't want to end up like that. You know? Many people are have these impulses where they say, this might not be real. But they sort of stuff that back in the box, you know, and go on with their lives. But every once in a while, somebody decides that what people call reality might not be real. And some of those people come to beginner's zazen. And they really, and you could think of Zen as all about like deconditioning the mind and the body and the heart. And undoing years of cultural and social conditioning. It's taking you out of the realm of the agreed upon truth and letting you experience the world in a different way. And this is, Mu Xin is so important because it's like short-circuiting all of those cultural messages that you've gotten, you know. We live in a culture which puts a very high premium on you could say physical comfort. You know? So you can get chairs that, you know, open up so that you can put your feet, you can spread your feet out and you can lie back and the chair actually flexes, you know. And then you can actually get one that has a vibrator on it, you know. So you can open the chair up and you can stretch out and then you can vibrate, you know. And that's a statement about, you know, what a culture, what our society thinks is important, you know. And the idea that you might sit for 3 days with discomfort in your legs would seem crazy in that framework, you know. As you, many of you have seen at this session, you know, and I've seen in past sessions, you're doing something a little strange, but the results can be quite astonishing. You know, it's like a whole different way of experiencing the world. And so Mu Xin takes you to this like zero place, and you're not relying on cultural common sense. You know, what people say is true. You're not relying on, your book learning, you know. And you're not even relying very much on language. I mean, you have to use some language, but you're not relying heavily on language. I mean, some koans defy reason and language in all kinds of ways. There's a koan that some of you are working on. If you have a staff, I'll give you one. And if you have no staff, I'll take it away. So the koan's asking you to notice something about the moment. And it's doing it in a way that short circuits your cultural conditioning and even your language to some degree. And if you do this, it's possible to have a very different experience of reality. And eventually, you know, Zen is, you know, people think of, Kensho experiences as always being like, you know, major earthquake-like experiences. But sometimes a Kensho can just be very subtle, you know. It could be just like that. Or it can just be a subtle recognition, you know. But it might make a lasting difference in the way you experience things. And it's like very cumulative. You know, yesterday I said it's like water on the rock, you know. You have this little insight, and then you have this little insight, and you have this little insight, or sometimes big insight, you know. But eventually it adds up to like a very different way of inhabiting the world. And it's quite different, you know. And in fact, you know, if you wire up people's heads, people have been doing this for a long time, process information in a very different way. You really go through some changes if you do Zen practice, and you find yourself at times deviating from the accepted reality. And the farther you go into this, the more that's going to happen to some degree. Now, at the same time, you don't become like a monster or something. You're able to function in the world. But psychologically, you have to be able to be different. You know, you have to be able to tolerate being different. And nobody at first wants to be different, you know. Nobody wants to be the odd duck, you know. But if you keep practicing, you know, one of the things that happens to you is you get this very, very tenacious or very, very stable self. Most people are afraid to step out of the collective reality because they think they'll be destroyed somehow, you know. They just think, if I deviate, I'll be destroyed, you know. It's like when I was a little kid, I remember being fascinated by the lamp in the living room. And the bulb fascinated me. And one time I unscrewed the bulb and I looked inside that, you know, cylinder. And I started to put my finger in there and my mother said, don't do that, you know. But I had to do it. And the lesson is, you know, always do what your mother says. But even though I loved my mother very much and she had my best interests at heart, it's actually not always good to do what your mother says, you know. But there's a kind of part of us that says, I might get a really bad electric shock if I do this, you know. But you could say that many times in your Zen practice you're put into a situation where you feel you're going to be destroyed. You know, you might say, I can't, this is something I just, if I had to put up with this, I just couldn't do it, you know. And you think, there's no way, you know, this would be the end, the death of me, as we say. So if somebody told you before your first session, you're going to come and you're going to be in pain for 5 days, and at the end you'll be happy about it, you'd just say, that's insane, you know. Or you'd say, no way, you know, I don't, pain for 5 days, I couldn't take that. You know? That would be the death of me, right? But, you know, if you, you know, we were talking yesterday about how to deal with pain, and you find that eye of the storm, right? You get to that very calm place, and you realize, this is amazing, you know, I'm able to deal with this, even though I thought it would destroy me. And, you know, pain is just, you know, it's, you know, when you have pain, you have this flight mechanism. You want to just get up and run. And when you don't do that, you know, and you're able to find that calm place, it's amazing. It's like being, for a minute, you know, when you really find it, it's like being invulnerable, you know. It's like, my gosh, you know, I'm bulletproof, you know. And of course, you know, as I said, Zen is all about going through this process, going through your barriers. So you get to a place where you think there's no way I could do this. You know, you might think, well, I mean, there are people for whom, you know, we get up at 4:30 in the morning and we go to bed at 10:30 at night. And for some people, you know, really just the very idea of getting up at 4:30 is unthinkable, you know. I mean, I think I know people who have never gotten up at 4:30 in their entire lives, you know, really. In fact, I think I'm related to people. And you think, oh, no, 4:30, no. No coffee, out of the question. No, but you do it and you think, this is not, gee, I thought this would destroy me, but lo and behold. And of course, you know, there are forms of behavior that function this way that aren't good for people. So like risk-taking behavior is like this, you know. I'll take my motorcycle and I will jump over four cars, right, you know. That would be a mistake, you know. So, but it's this, there's an impulse. The impulse is the same, though. You know, I know something's not right about reality, and I want to get out. And I haven't thought very carefully about how I'm going to do it. You know? So I'm going to take my motorcycle over four cars, right? And if it works, you do have this feeling like, you know, by gosh, you know, I'm not destroyed, you know. And in Zen too, there's something you think this is something I just could not do, you know. One more sit, you know, and I'll go stark raving mad, you know. One more whatever, and you come in and you sit down on the cushion, and instead of going mad, you suddenly get into this state where, you know, your mind is empty and you begin to have this deep sense of serenity or connectedness or wholeness, or, and you think, well, that's the darndest thing, you know. And so instead, you know, it's like, again, we use this term dying on the cushion. And it's like you think, this is it, this is the point beyond which I cannot go, and then you go beyond that point, and instead of being destroyed, you feel like you have a bigger life. And Zen, the life of Zen is the life of doing this again and again. And there's always a voice or voices in your head going, don't do it, you know. They go, don't do it, you know, you can't do it. Or, are you mad, you know? And again, there are forms of behavior that are really dangerous for people. And but the test is, at the end of doing it, are you more whole, more confident, more free, right? Are you more independent? Are you more compassionate? You know. And if you say yes, 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 then probably it's a good thing to do. If you're more fearful, angry, suspicious, insecure, dependent, you know, neurotically like dependent, then it's a bad thing to do. So you know, Zen is a process of like being destroyed, thinking you're going to be destroyed over and over again, and finding that you come out on the other side of this experience more with a bigger self, or, that's not quite right, you know, with a bigger life. We say in Zen, we say bigger self, but actually that's just a metaphor. The Indian monk who brought Zen to China was named Bodhidharma. And Bodhidharma taught the Lankavatara Sutra. That was his favorite sutra. And he was a Zen teacher. And if you read the Lankavatara Sutra, it says, it often talks about the true self. But then there's a part of the sutra where it says, whatever you think, don't think we're really talking about a self, because there isn't one there. Is that it's just a metaphor. Okay. That's what it actually says. So basically, we keep going to these situations where we think we'll be destroyed. And every time you think you'll be destroyed and you're not, you know, you come out on the other side in Zen with a deeper sense of connectedness, trust, wholeness. And it can be, you know, typically it involves an encounter with something that can produce, like a strong sense of fear, like you're going over a cliff or something, or aversion, like I despise this, or, you know, that kind of thing. And I hate this, you know, I hate this. One more second of this. Or of fear, you know. I was the kind of person who was very dependent on the good regard of my authority figures as a kid. As I mentioned, I was always the guy with the hand up in class. And as a teacher now, I realized what an annoying, horrible student I was, and how kind my teachers were. You know, because, you know, a teacher asks a question, the teacher doesn't want the same person to answer every question, right? You know, so it's like, let me throw a question out there, you answer it, and I'll go, that's very good, and then I'm waiting for others to participate. But every time I have, my hands up, and it would be like, my dream class would be, Kurt? Yes. Any new question? Kurt? Yes, excellent. Kurt? 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 Oh my God, that's great. Kurt, you know? So, when I would not get the approval, I would crumble inside, and I would just crumble. And I just fall apart. It wasn't just teachers, but, you know, I would just crumble, you know. I remember, even before I started doing Zen, I started reading books about people who were like not normal people. So I read a book by a guy named Jack Kerouac who hitchhiked across the United States. And in my high school, nobody read Jack Kerouac, you know. The idea of being a bum hitchhiking on the highway in the community, you know, I mean, I grew up in the most right-wing environment possible, you know. So, basically, you know, nobody said, oh, good idea. What an exciting adventure. You know, you'll be killed. Are you out of your mind? You know, you're going to be a bum, are you? You know. And I hitchhiked across the United States, and it was this great experience. You know, it was a really incredible experience. But you know, I remember just being terrified by it. You know. And in my travels, you know, you sometimes when you're hitchhiking, you just can get let off in the middle of nowhere. And for a kid who had such a protected and easy life, you know, being dropped off in the middle of nowhere, you know, by yourself, it was just terrifying. And I would just cry, you know. I mean, I remember, you know, like sleeping in the woods, you know, and, you know, by the highway, you know, and just like sobbing, you know. It's like, what am I doing? Am I out of my mind, you know? And just the sheer uncomfortableness of it all, you know. And yet, in retrospect, I think it was a very good thing. But I didn't have the resources inside of myself. I didn't have that stability. And that I didn't have that ability to tolerate uncertainty and adversity, right? The ability to, most people when they encounter adversity, they encounter an obstacle, they become more rigid and aggressive. You know, you can tell when somebody has been training for a long time. You know, when things go wrong, you often see an aspect of people, you know? So when things are really go wrong, people often like project their hostility in a very diffuse way. So if somebody's very stressed, you know, they can take it out on everybody. You know, they just start, everybody in their mind becomes like the opponent, you know? And you can see people who are under a lot of pressure, you know, it's nothing personal, but they just start lashing out, or they have a kind of edge to their behavior, you know. And that's because they don't have the resources for dealing with this kind of uncertainty, frustration, you know, and also adversity, you know. Sitting in the cold for 7 days in the biting cold, you know, you can try to be tough, but that doesn't work. You know, eventually you have to be more open. You have to quiet the judging part of your mind, and you just have to be open to what's happening in the moment. Even though your mind at some level is saying, "This, I hate this, I hate this, I hate this." And if you go through that process long enough, you become a very different kind of person. And you aren't easily daunted. You don't easily crumble. And let's face it, I mean, lots of people don't want human beings like that, you know? They want people who are going to be obedient and easily crumble easily, right? I know I'm running out of time, but I was just reading. There's like in the United States today among young people, there's like an epidemic of what's called narcissism, where all of these young people are very self-absorbed, and it's because they've been educated to have. They've been told you're a very special. Every person's special in his own way. You know, everybody's special. Everybody's good. Everybody's excellent, as a matter of fact. Everybody. And you just have to find, you're already excellent, you just have to find the way you're excellent. See? And this is actually, instead of producing strong people, this has produced a people who are like deeply, deeply insecure. Because of course it's such a lie, right? It's just a sheer lie. You know, everybody isn't excellent. That's just the truth. You know, I am never going to be a great literary critic. And I have friends who are brilliant literary critics. And it's not like inside of me there's an inner critic that can't get out. He's just not there. And believe it or not, you know, I mean, I thought I was going to be a great writer when I was a kid, but, you know, there's just not a great writer in there. It's not like, oh, yes, there is, if you could just get in touch with your inner writer. No, really not there. However, I know people who are brilliant writers, you know. So telling people everybody's excellent already without any, that's poison. So we've created a whole country of young people who are told, you're great, you're wonderful, you're special. And then, you know, they get into the first job and some guy says, you know, they turn in a report and the boss goes, what is this crap? Right? And they fall apart. It's happening all over the country. And, you know, then they rush to the doctor and go, you know, it's sad. And then they go, oh my God, you know, I'm deeply depressed. I can't sleep, you know. And of course, the doctors are only too happy to write, you know, 40 scripts and say, you know. But the thing is, you know, it's because they haven't been given opportunities to almost be destroyed and then to come away more whole. You know, so like these programs that, you know, take people out into the desert and they spend a week, you know, and roughing it, it's actually very good for people. You know, because they think, oh, you know, I could never cook my own meal. You know, I could never do that, you know. I could never go without a shower for a week, you know, that would be unthinkable, you know, and no fresh towels, you know. But, you know, it turns out, you know, they freeze, they burn in the sun, you know, they get parched and they don't have any water and stuff. But at the end of it, they go, gee, I actually wasn't destroyed. And they come away with a greater stability of self, you know. And Zen is all about that, you know. It's a much more profound, Zen has many elements, but one of the key elements is developing an imperturbable mind. When you're in Mushin, you can encounter, you know, the cold, the heat, annoyances, you follow them back to Mu, and your mind is stable and placid in the middle of a madhouse. Right? In the middle of a madhouse, you can be on a busy street corner in a chaotic world. You can be absolutely stable. And this may not be where you are right now, but you know, you will be pleasantly surprised. You know? So please cultivate today Mushin. Nonsense. A monk said to Nansen, is there any Dharma that has not been preached to the people? And Nansen says, there is. He said, what is it? And he said, it's not mind, it's not Buddha, it's not things. Don't cling to conditions. If your happiness is dependent on conditions, you're not in Mushin. If your calmness is dependent on conditions, you're not in Mushin. If your joy is dependent on conditions, you're not in Mushin. You're not following the way. So anyway, please follow the way.